A presidential election is coming up in 2020. Unfortunately, the entire apparatus of the media has leaped into action more than a year before to tell us all what is going to happen. The latest? President Trump will win re-election by a landslide. What are the chances this is true? We're going to talk about it in podcast 848, the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, it is hot. And, you know, if you've had the same air conditioner for 10 years, chances are it's going to quit working at some point. The longer it is hot, the more the chances are that thing's going to break. Plus, is it efficient? So when you think about air conditioning, I want you to think about Ryan Plumbing and Heating of St. Paul for home or business, because when it comes to keeping all these systems running right, you need somebody who really knows what they're doing. And especially if you have an old AC system, it might be time to look at doing something more efficient, because the efficiency kind of pays for itself. When you have plumbing or air conditioning problems, you want reliable service. Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, you call 651-224-4771. In Minneapolis, 612-927-6488. They go back four generations in Frogtown in St. Paul. Quality replacement and repair of all plumbing, heating, and air conditioning systems. How are the toilets in your house? Are they 60 years old and running all the time? These are the kinds of questions that they can help you with. So residential and business, Ryan Plumbing at ryanplumbing.com. So the air show is definitely coming up. In fact, my guys from Alpha Systems are getting ready to head over there just at the end of this week. If you're a pilot and you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, you owe it to yourself to check out Alpha Systems. I think in Building 3 or Building C, I can't remember the designation. I know it's the third building where they'll be demonstrating the angle of attack indicator. The bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives because it is a visual indicator of the amount of lift your wing is producing. It's right over the instrument panel, not on the instrument panel, so you look right through it. You don't have to look around for it, and it really helps you on takeoffs and landings because of those turns. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at thebobdavispodcast.com. It's right at the top of the page. All right, let me say at the outset, we've just had a big storm here, and usually I record late. But tonight, all of the flights that have been stacked up because of this big storm are now being brought in to Minneapolis and St. Paul Airport, so they're flying right over the house. And so I've opened the window, and the reason for that is when the window's closed, I can hear them in my headphones. I'm not sure that you can hear them. This way, you will be able to hear them, and I will hear them, and so it won't bother me as much. All right? So that's the first disclaimer for this podcast. So let me start by saying that the most important thing to know about elections is that the outcome of elections are determined by who votes, not those who do not vote. That's the most important thing to remember. It has been that way since the beginning of elections, that it's determined by who actually votes. And usually what happens is after the fact, so after the election, pundits and analysts, political scientists, so-called commentators and politicians provide their reasons why so-and-so won election. And it's usually based on exit polling theories, political polls before and after, and by sifting through the election data, by margins of turnout, and by region, and so forth. Some of these theories are good, and some of them aren't so good. But this is the source for what later become truisms or shibboleths for both political parties. And they usually congeal into, quote, explanations of why somebody won or somebody didn't win. And most of them, especially the ones that are the first blush, are later proven to be incorrect. Furthermore, while we have so-called national elections in the United States every 4 years, actual elections are the business of the state. So they are conducted and controlled locally, and they're subject to state laws as well as some federal election law. But for the most part, constitutionally, states actually run the elections. So that's important to point out. So to repeat, elections turn on who shows up to vote as far as what issues drive them, what somebody said, what happened 2 weeks before the election, long-term trends in political thought. These things may or may not come to bear in an election and therefore may or may not matter. What matters are vote totals, and vote totals do not say who voted or why. Exit polls do, but that's not everybody who voted. They just say what local precincts the voters live in at the time of the election and what percentage of the population in that precinct turned out to vote and how they voted. And you can compare those to previous elections, but the bottom line is that's what the vote totals provide. The ballot, our ballots do not have our name, age, sex, income, or anything else on them. Registration data only includes name, address, and sometimes telephone number or ID number, right? Depends on the state law. And in many states, you don't even need to register. So the why is often elusive and takes years to figure out because the data is just not there. So a lot of times people project things into numbers that may or may not be there. The resolution of some of those why questions sometimes comes usually after a series of elections. So political scientists will tell you, if we're looking at long-term trends, then we're looking at a presidential election, an off-year House and Senate election, a presidential election, an off-year House and Senate election, and local elections and special elections and primary votes and things of that nature. Usually they don't even look at primary votes. They look at the grand totals and grand totals of votes regarding and turnout regarding each of these elections every 2 years in this country. My point here is this. The most salient fact in an election is the vote itself. You can't say that often enough because I don't think people understand. Sometimes I think people think polling is data. Sometimes they think that, or polling data is votes. Sometimes they think that post-election exit polls are somehow votes. No, those are, research tools that political scientists and media companies use for various reasons. So when you hear some commentator on one of these cable channels or talk radio or podcasting saying that so-and-so is going to do this or something is going on in this country, most of the time they don't know any more than you and I on any subject that they may be discussing. So what they're trying to do is get reaction, or worse, they are actually grinding a political axe for one of these major political contributors like the Koch brothers or the Mercers or Tom Steyer or someone to that effect. So if you go around and you eavesdrop on local conversations at restaurants or whatever, you're often going to hear people simply repeat what they heard on some podcast or on a television show or on talk radio. And they sound very authoritative when they repeat this stuff. Most of the time, people do not avail themselves of public information to fact check what somebody said on Rachel Maddow or what Sean Hannity said or what any one of these other people said on their little platform, oftentimes being paid by somebody to get a point of view out. What they are doing is they are telling you their opinion, and most of the time they are paid to give you an opinion. Sometimes somebody wants to feed into discussions like those you overhear at the club or at the Red Lobster on King Crab Night in the next on the next table. The latest is Trump is going to win by a landslide. People hear others saying it, and then they repeat it. It doesn't matter why it is being said, and I guarantee you, most people don't say, you know, honey, let's look at the election data and see how Trump did in the battleground states, and then we'll decide whether we think it's possible for him to win a landslide. What we have in this country right now, and we're going to speak specifically about the Republicans here since we are talking about asserting that President Trump is going to win by a landslide. You have a bunch of triumphant Trump supporters, and Trump can do no wrong. He is the best president ever, and so this fits right into their narrative. Trump will win by a landslide because he's an amazing, incredible political leader. And none of them, I guarantee you, are ever going to ask, how is that possible? How would he win by a landslide? How do you manage a landslide victory in a presidential bid? What are the factors that are involved? Now, I want people to understand, I am not saying it can't happen or won't happen. I'm not making fun of the president. I'm not making fun of the so-called Trump zombies. In the second half of this podcast, I'm going to explain to you why they are saying what they are saying. And then we're going to look at what it would take for this to happen. Well, it was just the 4th of July, which celebrates the American Revolution. Guess what? There is a revolution going on in this country. It's called the Payment Processing Revolution. Who is your payment processor? Can they integrate seamlessly with all of your accounting systems? Can they integrate seamlessly with your CRM? Can they integrate seamlessly with all the things that you're doing? Let's suppose you have guys out and you're using swiping cards on phone apps, things of that nature. If you have a business, you know how important payment processing is. Moreover, you know how important it is to have a payment processor that really knows how to work with you to get things done. That is ReliaFund at ReliaFund.com. They're a payment processor. They've been providing integrated solutions to get payments cleared for more than 2 decades. That means working with you, the business owner. If you're developing an e-commerce site, if you are working on your back office stuff, they will work with your developer to make sure this thing works for you. They've been doing it for 20 years. No long-term contracts. Secure and technology-focused. 866-243-5040. That's 866-243-5040. You will talk to a human being, Greg Lowry or Kevin Hill, and they're great. Or you can check them out online at ReliaFund.com, R-E-L-I-A-F-U-N-D. If you click on the banner at the top of the page at the BobDavisPodcast.com, it goes to their landing page, which asks you questions, and then they will get back to you. Of course, that's how I found them. So check them out online at ReliaFund.com. Now, you heard me mention Ryan Plumbing a little earlier in the podcast because your AC may be just about to give up the ghost. You can either have it checked, which is a good thing, or you can actually talk to Ryan about installing a new system that will be much more efficient. If you have problems with your AC, don't forget Ryan Plumbing and Heating in St. Paul, 651-224-4771 in Minneapolis, 612-927-6488 online at ryanplumbing.com. So, in 2016, Donald J. Trump's team and the Republican Party engineered what some have called a surprise electoral victory, an historical event. That is, the president was able to win more than the required 270 electoral votes necessary to clinch the presidency, despite Hillary Clinton's clear win in the popular vote. Not the first time it happened, but it happened in spades this time around. No, the polls did not say Hillary Clinton would win. If you listen to any of my podcasts, which covered the election and actually looked at every single poll in every single state 3 different times before the election, you would know that those polls actually indicated close races in key battleground states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, to name two. In fact, it was the pundits who said that Hillary Clinton would win by a landslide. The president, in other words, President Trump, eked out marginal victories in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and he won a healthy margin of the vote, something like 8 points in Ohio and almost 6 points in Georgia and roughly 4 points in North Carolina and a few other states. I did look up the numbers before this podcast, but I'm just going to use round numbers. So these are not exact, but it gives you an idea of his margins. I think in Arizona, he won by something like 4 points, and in Florida, he won by about a 3% margin. So without going into too much detail, Hillary Clinton won by about 3 points in Minnesota, 0.3 of a point in New Hampshire, and roughly 2.5 points in Nevada, and 3 points in Colorado. One of the things people do these days is look at a presidential election map of the United States, and they don't have any numbers in terms of margins. They just say if a state voted Republican in total, it's a red state, and if a state voted Democrat in total, it's a blue state. In fact, most of the time the vote is mixed, and margins for presidential races, as in every political race, are usually within 5 points or 4 points. Sometimes they're more than that. A landslide in a state election would be more than 10 points, I would think. So what people will do is look at these maps, and when they see the map, whether it's county by county or state by state, there are huge swaths of blue or red, depending on which party won the presidency. Usually if it's all blue or it's all red, and this time around in 2016, huge swaths of the country were red. It looked like President Trump just crushed it. But it ignores the fact that Hillary Clinton and the Democrats won most of the big population centers on the East and West Coast, like California and Massachusetts, and in the Midwest with Illinois and Minnesota. So it's easy to look at that map like that and make a conclusion when you know what one of the variables in the next election is going to be and say, gee, all he'd have to do or all she'd have to do is dot, 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 and that's it. Here's the thing. We don't know what's going to happen in 2020 yet. I think you can say with some degree of confidence that Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, but you don't know that. And we certainly don't know who the Democratic nominee is. So if we have one variable that we can be fairly sure of, it's easy to say, well, he's going to smoke somebody. And here's the reality. First of all, I think we can say with some degree of confidence that there are states that you can take off the table for the Republicans, and there are states you can take off the table for Democrats before we even get into factoring all that into how the election might conceivably roll. Especially if you factor in 2018 off your election data, which I'm going to talk about later in this podcast. So let's talk about the Democrats first. More than likely, Democrats are going to win Oregon, Washington, and California, and Hawaii, and in the Mountain West, they will win New Mexico. More than likely, Democrats can depend on winning New England, which includes Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, New England, with a wild card possibility in New Hampshire. Also, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Delaware, Rhode Island, Maryland, and Virginia. Though, as you'll see, Virginia could be in the play for Republicans a little bit in 2020 just because of some of the things that have been happening down there recently. Republicans can possibly count on winning most of the Mountain West, with the exceptions above, most of the Mid-South and South from Iowa and Missouri to Tennessee, and that includes Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, and Oklahoma, will vote Republican. In the Deep South, Republicans can probably count on Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. That leaves several states possibly as battlegrounds for various reasons, usually demographic, either for the Republicans or for in the favor of the Democrats, either one. In the West, Arizona, Colorado, and Nevada are in play for both parties with no guarantees. In the Midwest, Wisconsin and Michigan in particular, states which have traditionally voted Democratic were won by Trump by very thin margins in 2016. Ohio has voted Democrat and Republican over the years, with Northern Ohio, so Cleveland, Akron, and so forth, operating on a completely different frequency from Southern Ohio. So the Great Lakes region is different from the coal mining region, the South Central region of the state, completely different kind of makeup. Just like Illinois, Southern Illinois is completely different from Northern Illinois and Cook County in Chicago and points south all the way down to the tip of Illinois, which is Kentucky. Southern Illinois tends to be Republican, but Northern Illinois has so many Democrat votes with Chicago that it overwhelms. So Ohio is one of those states that has been split. And it's important to point that out because sometimes presidents can win Ohio by a couple of points, and sometimes they win by 10 points. Trump did pretty well in Ohio, and I don't want to go too far off the reservations here because I want to stay on the subject here. In 2018, I also think we saw that Texas is a potentially easier battleground for Democrats, which was a surprise. Texas usually votes Republican and has been a Republican bellwether for a long time, but people from the North have been moving into Houston and Dallas and Austin and San Antonio and so forth for a long time. So if anything, the O'Rourke candidacy proved that that Ted Cruz was potentially beatable, and that Texas could potentially be a state that the Democrats could conceivably win. I don't know that they regard it as a state that they could win, but that's one of the takeaways from the off-year elections. Finally, in the Deep South, Florida was also home to a deeply contested governor's race and, I believe, one House race. So here again, South Florida has a slightly different political makeup from the West Coast and Northern Florida and a lot more people. So South Florida is key. Georgia was home to a number of close races in 2018, and that puts this state into question to a certain degree for the Republicans, even though Trump won it by a wide margin. In 2016, moderate Republican leadership forced Donald J. Trump at their convention as the party's choice for president. Had the convention been able to run free, it is possible Ted Cruz or even John Kasich could have been the nominee, one vice president, one president, or vice versa. Not making any predictions about who would have won, but the convention was truncated and the Trump team basically took over, and there was almost a fait accompli nomination and vote for Donald Trump to be the standard bearer for the Republicans. Similarly, the Democratic Party convention pushed through Hillary Clinton as their standard bearer after Senator Bernie Sanders was forced to step aside by the fact that Hillary Clinton in the Democratic Party had, you know, the superdelegates are much more important, or were much more important in 2016. And so she was able to push Bernie Sanders aside by maneuvering the superdelegates. So then we get to 2018. As the president solidified his hold on the Republican Party with the resignations of moderate Republicans Rance Priebus and the retirement of Paul Ryan, as well as others in the administration, the president then began to make decisions about funding for campaigns and supporting candidates and which candidates he would support at his discretion in 2018. In the end, Trump had to triage the money to hold the House to switch over to the Senate because there was a great danger that he was going to lose the Senate. And in a couple of states which are considered Republican bellwethers, Arizona in particular, he did lose. Their Sinema won the senatorial contest. The result of that election was a loss of about 40 seats in the House, many long-term incumbent Republican congressmen losing their seats, while the Republicans maintained their majority in the Senate at great cost. It took almost all the resources of the Republican Party to get it done, including later appointing a Republican to the seat vacated by Senator John McCain by his death in Arizona. So the Republicans maintained a majority in the Senate, but at the cost of the House. I think that's significant, and I think 2018 looms large in this conversation about landslides. So electoral predictions are notoriously difficult and often wrong, but to win a landslide electoral vote, the president has to win all the states he won in 2016, including those by the very thin margins, like Michigan and Wisconsin, which Hillary Clinton refused to campaign in during the 2016 campaign. Do you think the Democrats will make the same mistake in 2020? He also has to win Pennsylvania, which, as I recall, he won by about 3/10 of a point. He also has to win Ohio again, regardless of what happens. And, you know, I would say his chances of winning Ohio, if you look at last, if you look at 2016, you would say they're pretty good. But if you look at 2018, where a number of congressmen lost their seats and where I believe they lost the governorship, well, then that's another thing entirely. So you have to look at governors and attorneys general and the performance of the party in 2018 as a predicate to 2020. So for a landslide, I would think he has to win Arizona and Colorado. One state he won and one state he didn't win. He lost Colorado by 4 points. Nevada, he lost by 4 or 5 points. Minnesota, he lost by 4 points or so. And one of those two wouldn't hurt either. But in the upper Midwest, he has to win Ohio. He has to win Michigan. He has to win Wisconsin. If he wants a landslide, he's got to win Minnesota. This is where the real battlegrounds are. Some of these states featured spectacular losses by Republican House and Senate candidates during the 2016 cycle and during special elections in 2017. This is also true in Arizona and Texas and the spine of the California Valley, which has traditionally been Republican, which they lost. And by the way, when I talk about off-year elections, you know, the special elections in 2017, at least one of those candidates was famously backed by the president. So this also throws into question Florida and Texas, and close races in Georgia and North Carolina also throw those states in as well. Now, Trump won North Carolina, but it still was a close race. I would not presume to tell you whether it isn't possible or what is going to happen in the coming months when it comes to national politics is anything that I could predict, because I wouldn't even try to. And I don't really have a dog in the fight, because I believe very strongly that I need to recuse myself from even having an opinion. I certainly have political opinions. I've often outlined them. I'm not going to do it in this podcast because it's a waste of time for everybody. But if you consider the 2018 election as any indication, this would suggest that 2010, 2012, and 2016 were essentially high water marks for Republicans, at least on the legislative front and in the state legislatures and governor's mansions. But in 2018, that began to change, and significantly. And that's important. I would say that if the president even wants to repeat his electoral victory in 2020 that he had in 2016, he is facing headwinds just based on the raw vote tallies about who won what and by how much in 2018. For example, demographically, many of the so-called millennial 18 to 24-year-olds by now are going to be 25 to 34-year-olds, much more likely to vote than they were when they were 18 or 19 or 20 or 22, let's say. And more younger people are migrating from central cities to the so-called purple suburban districts, making them yet more purple. Same goes for some states which used to be solidly Republican, like Arizona and Colorado. Why am I saying that? Well, when you're 22, you want to live downtown with your friends and drink beer and go to bars and have a great time. When you're 25, you've had a kid and now you start looking for a house. And if you're paying attention to the real estate market, well, you can't afford a house in the central city because those houses are over $500,000 now. So a lot of places, they are going out to these suburbs to try to find two-bedroom and three-bedroom houses for, you know, a reasonable cost. So those people, are moving in. And if they were Democrats as 18, 20, 22-year-olds, probably going to be Democrats when they get into the suburbs. Doesn't mean they will or they won't. Doesn't mean that maybe the tax situation changes their mind. I don't know. I'm just saying that demographically, a lot of these places that used to be smaller suburbs in various parts of most metros that were solidly Republican when the cities were solidly Democrat are beginning to change in terms of their vote totals. Same goes for some states which used to be solidly Republican, like Arizona and Colorado, which you really can't say anymore. So again, victory in an election depends on who gets their people out to vote. In 2016, the Democratic voter turnout was flat overall, but among blacks, it was much lower, and a surge in the Latino vote for Democratic candidates never materialized in 2016. The Republican turnout in 2016 was only slightly higher than 2012 for Mitt Romney, who famously lost Ohio and Pennsylvania as returns from heavily urban districts came in late. Overall, about 58% of the eligible voters went to the polls in 2016. Obviously, the key problem for Democrats was that black people did not vote, and the key takeaway for Republicans was they managed to get so-called disenfranchised white males with low levels of education to vote for Trump. Now, some argue with that. They say that women voted for Trump in slightly higher numbers. They did. But I look at it and I say that if anything, when you're talking about Ohio and you're talking about Pennsylvania and you're talking about Wisconsin and Michigan in particular, a loss in the black vote in terms of turnout is significant. And I think the biggest problem with Democrats is they nominated Hillary Clinton. I think even if they had nominated Bernie Sanders, things might have been different. If you took 2016 as kind of a weird, quirky year. The key takeaway from voter turnout was among Democrats in 2018, the 18 to 34 vote climbed 15%, with voters under 30 leaning Democratic by as much as 30%. 30 to 44 voters turned out more than 10 points higher than in 2016. 45 to 64-year-olds, 10 points, and 65-plus by about 6 points. In 2018, fewer Republicans voted than Democrats. This suggests a trend toward higher Democrat vote totals than in 2016 and for 2020, especially if the president is the issue. In conclusion, It all depends on the voter turnout, as I've said four times. One might ask at this time, what are the two political parties working on in terms of voter turnout? What is the block-by-block fruition of the efforts? What specifically are those efforts? Who is better at those efforts? Who has paid employees on the street, door knocking, et cetera? I've already had two or three people come to my front door, and none of them have been Republicans. That's just an example. And I think the lesson there is generally Republicans rely on campaign volunteers in statewide campaigns, Senate or governor campaigns. We won't have a governor's campaign this year in Minnesota. Democrats rely on agencies, unions, and other political pressure groups that are constantly polling block by block. And so the Republican voter turnout effort is probably not as robust as the Democrats. In other words, can we drive you to the poll today? What about absentee ballots, which are beginning to be a much more significant element in these elections, as well as early voting? So if Democrats, using all the tools that they tend to use, are able to turn out Northern Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, and Cincinnati, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh, South Florida, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Denver, Boulder, and Atlanta, if they can get that Latino vote to materialize, especially in the Southwest, especially black voters in Detroit and Flint and Milwaukee, and particularly black and younger voters who are much more likely to vote Democrat, then they can potentially block the president from winning those very, very tight victories that he won in 2016 in those electoral rich states in the Midwest. Moreover, states like Arizona and even Texas, as I said, and Georgia can be in play in 2020 when they weren't necessarily in play in 2016, because these areas around the major cities like Atlanta, Minneapolis and St. Paul, Chicago, you know, that's a bad example, but let's just say Akron, Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati are, as I said, you've got people moving into the suburbs who are not traditionally Republican. Some of those people are younger and they vote Democrat. So you're starting to see these areas that were solidly Republican, not so solid, just 4 years later. And even just 2 years later, if you count 2018 in the mix in terms of turnout. So the president could win Wisconsin and even Minnesota, but lose Florida and Ohio or Ohio. He could also lose Arizona or win Nevada. And if he doesn't do what he did before, so if he doesn't win Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Ohio, and it's a mix and match game where he loses Ohio and loses Florida. Well, if he loses Ohio and Florida, it's over. If he loses one of those, he's got to make up that electoral vote totals by winning Arizona and Colorado. And the question is, can he? He's going to have to win one of the states that he didn't win. So he's going to have to win Minnesota and Wisconsin, or Minnesota and Michigan, or Michigan and New Hampshire, and one of the Democrat states that he didn't win before. I don't know if that's an equation that works out. On the other hand, and I think this is important, Trump could get higher turnouts. Keep in mind what he had in 2016. If he gets higher turnouts in places like Virginia, Nevada, or Colorado, or Minnesota, well, then you never know. It could turn out to be completely different, because success, even by small margins in some of those electoral-rich states, could constitute a, quote, landslide victory, electorally speaking, for him. And, of course, he would also win the popular vote in a lot of those states. Polls do not predict elections. Polls only track the impact of fast-moving storms of public opinion. Polls only show probabilities within 3 points one way or another, even when average. Almost all the predictions lately, the latest one is Newt Gingrich, who says he's going to win by a landslide, based on an Emerson Research poll, which showed him ahead of all the other Democrat candidates. And yet every single other poll shows him well behind all the other Democratic candidates. So right now that are running in the primary. So if you averaged all the polls, he still isn't ahead. So there's just no predicate for saying that he's going to win by a landslide. Doesn't mean he won't, but saying it doesn't mean it's true. The entire game, and that's what it is going to depend on turnout for both parties in 2020. The question is, which team is going to show up? And I think that's the key thing. And I will let you be the judge of that. But the next time somebody tells you Trump is going to win or lose by a landslide, they're probably making it up. We just have to wait and see what the vote is. Finally, there's a lot of talk about President Reagan's first tax cut, which was the Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1981, and also it's referred to as the Kemp-Roth tax cut. It was the largest tax cut in history, slashing tax rates for the highest income brackets from 70% to 50% over 3 years, and even cutting taxes for the lowest income brackets from 14 to 11%. Economic growth in Reagan's first 4 years, and even if you throw in 1984, averaged roughly 4%. Much higher than today's roughly 2.5% or even 3%. Moreover, tax rates have been cut and cut again and again between Obama and Bush for the lower middle income brackets, with some of those lower brackets now paying zero tax. So just because Trump passed Paul Ryan's Tax Reform Act of 1986 addendum, it may not have the same effect electorally as Reagan's. Moreover, although everyone is saying the economy is booming, the fact is the GDP average was about 3.3% for the first quarter of this year, and it's projected to be below that for the second quarter. Given the difference in landscape, saying the president will have a landslide victory because of the tax cut, just like Reagan, is just unicorns and rainbows, zombie Trumper style. Trump may indeed win re-election, but I think given the improved turnout for Democrats, if it holds, it is going to be quite the uphill battle for the president to get re-elected, let alone a landslide. Doesn't mean it won't happen, but I'm just giving you the lay of the land. So there you go. I like to occasionally re-engage politically, but not on an issue. And there's an awful lot of talk about what's going on and how it's going to affect the election and everything else. I'm going to tell you, nothing is going to affect the outcome of the election until about 30 days before November 6th, I think it is, 2020. So this whole thing about this is going on and that means this and this means that, really we don't even pay attention to that stuff until the last 60 days and in particular the last 30. So that's what's important. And as far as the other stuff, it always helps to look at data, and it's all available, and I'll put links up on the website for all of these different things that I look at in terms of state-by-state totals and so forth. Look at it yourself and draw your own conclusions. Thanks for listening to the Bob Davis Podcast on Stitcher.com, iTunes, our two services I've been with, syndication services, for a long, long time, blogtalkradio.com, but I'm also on Spotify, Spreaker.com, and a lot of these services, Google Play Music, Alexa works with TuneIn, and of course, they're all available from these different services like Podbean and Podsearch and so forth. Thanks for liking, sharing, favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter, and thanks again for your donations for Mobile Podcast Command at thebobdavispodcasts.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 848. We will find out what will happen next year.
No food on my table, and no shoes go on my feet. No food on my table, and no shoes go on my feet. My children cried for mercy. They got no priest to call their own. Hard times, hard times. Hard times seem like it's yet a